Dune Messiah by Frank Herbert, continued. Cassette 1, Side 2. Paul smiled at the memory, slipped out of his stillsuit. He stood naked and oddly attuned to his world. Dune was a world of paradox now, a world under siege, yet the center of power. To come under siege, he decided, was the inevitable fate of power. He stared down at the green carpeting, feeling its rough texture against his soles. The streets had been ankle-deep in sand blown over the shield wall on the stratus wind. Foot traffic had churned it into choking dust, which clogged stillsuit filters. He could smell the dust even now, despite a blower cleaning at the portals of his keep. It was an odor full of desert memories. Other days, other dangers. Compared to those other days, the peril in his lonely walks remained minor. But putting on a stillsuit, he put on the desert. The suit, with all its apparatus for reclaiming his body's moisture, guided his thoughts in subtle ways, fixed his movements in a desert pattern. He became Wild Fremen. More than a disguise, the suit made of him a stranger to his city self. In the stillsuit, he abandoned security and put on the old skills of violence. Pilgrims and townfolk passed him then with eyes downcast. They left the Wild One strictly alone, out of prudence. If the desert had a face for city folk, it was a Fremen face concealed by a stillsuit's mouth-nose filters. In truth, there existed now only the small danger that someone from the old siege days might mark him by his walk, by his odor, or by his eyes. Even then, the chances of meeting an enemy remained small. A swish of door hangings and a wash of light broke his reverie. Chani entered, bearing his coffee service on a platinum tray. Two slaved glow globes followed her, darting to their positions, one at the head of their bed, one hovering beside her to light her work. Chani moved with an ageless air of fragile power, so self-contained, so vulnerable. Something about the way she bent over the coffee service reminded him then of their first days. Her features remained darkly elfin, seemingly unmarked by their years, unless one examined the outer corners of her whiteless eyes, noting the lines there. Sand tracks, the Fremen of the desert called them. Steam wafted from the pot as she lifted the lid by its Hagar emerald knob. He could tell the coffee wasn't yet ready by the way she replaced the lid. The pot, fluting silver female shape, pregnant, had come to him as a ganima, a spoil of battle won when he'd slain the former owner in single combat. Jamis, that had been the man's name. Jamis. What an odd immortality death had earned for Jamis. Knowing death to be inevitable, had Jamis carried that particular one in his hand? Chani put out cups, blue pottery squatting like attendants beneath the immense pot. There were three cups, one for each drinker, and one for all the former owners.
"It'll only be a moment," she said.
She looked at him then, and Paul wondered how he appeared in her eyes. Was he yet the exotic off-worlder, slim and wiry, but water-fat when compared to Fremen? Had he remained the usul of his tribal name who'd taken her in Fremen Tau while they'd been fugitives in the desert? Paul stared down at his own body. Hard muscles, slender, a few more scars, but essentially the same despite 12 years as Emperor. Looking up, he glimpsed his face in a shelf mirror. Blue Fremen eyes, mark of spice addiction. A sharp Atreides nose. He looked the proper grandson for an Atreides who'd died in the bull ring, creating a spectacle for his people. Something the old man had said slipped then into Paul's mind.
"One who rules assumes irrevocable responsibility for the ruled. You are a husbandman. This demands, at times, a selfless act of love which may only be amusing to those you rule."
People still remembered that old man with affection.
"And what have I done for the Atreides name?" Paul asked himself. "I've loosed the wolf among the sheep."
For a moment, he contemplated all the death and violence going on in his mind.
"Into bed now,"
Chani said in a sharp tone of command that Paul knew would have shocked his imperial subjects. He obeyed, lay back with his hands behind his head, letting himself be lulled by the pleasant familiarity of Chani's movements. The room around them struck him suddenly with amusement. It was not at all what the populace must imagine as the Emperor's bedchamber. The yellow light of restless glow-globes moved the shadows in an array of colored glass jars on a shelf behind Chani. Paul named their contents silently. The dry ingredients of the desert pharmacopoeia. Unguents, incense, mementos. A pinch of sand from Siege Tabor. A lock of hair from their firstborn. Long dead. 12 years dead.
an innocent bystander killed in the battle that had made Paul emperor. The rich odor of spice coffee filled the room. Paul inhaled, his glance falling on a yellow bowl beside the tray where Chani was preparing the coffee. The bowl held ground nuts. The inevitable poison snooper mounted beneath the table, waved its insect arms over the food. The snooper angered him. They'd never needed snoopers in the desert days.
"Coffee's ready," Chani said. "Are you hungry?"
His angry denial was drowned in the whistling scream of a spice lighter hurling itself spaceward from the field outside Arakeen. Chani saw his anger, though, poured their coffee, put a cup near his hand. She sat down on the foot of the bed, exposed his legs, began rubbing them where the muscles were knotted from walking in the stillsuit. Softly, with a casual air which did not deceive him, she said,
"Let us discuss Irulan's desire for a child."
Paul's eyes snapped wide open. He studied Chani carefully. "Irulan's been back from Wallach less than 2 days," he said. "Has she been at you already?"
"We've not discussed her frustrations," Chani said.
Paul forced his mind to mental alertness, examined Chani in the harsh light of observational minutiae, the Bene Gesserit way his mother had taught him in violation of her vows. It was a thing he didn't like doing with Chani. Part of her hold on him lay in the fact he so seldom needed his tension-building powers with her. Chani mostly avoided indiscreet questions. She maintained a Fremen sense of good manners. Hers were more often practical questions. What interested Chani were facts which bore on the position of her man, his strength in council, the loyalty of his legions, the abilities and talents of his allies. Her memory held catalogues of names and cross-indexed details. She could rattle off the major weakness of every known enemy, the potential dispositions of opposing forces, battle plans of their military leaders, the tooling and production capacities of basic industries. Why now, Paul wondered, did she ask about Irulan?
"I've troubled your mind," Chani said. "That wasn't my intention."
"What was your intention?" She smiled shyly, meeting his gaze.
"If you're angered, love, please don't hide it."
Paul sank back against the headboard. "Shall I put her away?" he asked. "Her use is limited now, and I don't like the things I sense about her trip home to the sisterhood."
"You'll not put her away," Chani said.
She went on massaging his legs, spoke matter-of-factly.
"You've said many times she's your contact with our enemies, that you can read their plans through her actions."
"Then why ask about her desire for a child?"
"I think it'd disconcert our enemies and put Irulan in a vulnerable position should you make her pregnant."
He read by the movements of her hands on his legs what that statement had cost her. A lump rose in his throat. Softly, he said,
"Chani, beloved, I swore an oath never to take her into my bed. A child would give her too much power. Would you have her displace you?" "I have no place."
"Not so, Sahaya, my desert springtime. What is this sudden concern for Irulan?"
"It's concern for you, not for her. If she carried an Atreides child, her friends would question her loyalties. The less trust our enemies place in her, the less use she is to them."
"A child for her could mean your death," Paul said. "You know the plotting in this place." A movement of his arm encompassed the keep.
"You must have an heir," she husked.
"Ah," he said. So that was it. Chani had not produced a child for him. Someone else, then, must do it. Why not Irulan? That was the way Chani's mind worked. And it must be done in an act of love, because all the Empire avowed strong taboos against artificial ways. Chani had come to a Fremen decision. Paul studied her face in this new light. It was a face he knew better in some ways than his own. He had seen this face soft with passion, in the sweetness of sleep, awash in fears and angers and griefs. He closed his eyes, and Chani came into his memories as a girl once more, veiled in springtime, singing, waking from sleep beside him, so perfect that the very vision of her consumed him. In his memory she smiled, shyly at first, then strained against the vision as though she longed to escape. Paul's mouth went dry. For a moment, his nostrils tasted the smoke of a devastated future, and the voice of another kind of vision commanding him to disengage. 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 His prophetic visions had been eavesdropping on eternity for such a long while, catching snatches of foreign tongues, listening to stones and to flesh not his own. Since the day of his first encounter with terrible purpose, he had peered at the future, hoping to find peace. There existed a way, of course. He knew it by heart without knowing the heart of it. A rote future, strict in its instructions to him. Disengage, disengage, disengage.
Paul opened his eyes, looked at the decision in Shawnee's face. She had stopped massaging his legs, sat still now, purest Fremen. Her features remained familiar beneath the blue Nijoni scarf she often wore about her hair in the privacy of their chambers. But the mask of decision sat on her, an ancient and alien to him way of thinking. Fremen women had shared their men for thousands of years, not always in peace, but with a way of making the fact non-destructive. Something mysteriously Fremen in this fashion had happened in Chani.
"You'll give me the only heir I want," he said.
"You've seen this?" she asked, making it obvious by her emphasis that she referred to prescience.
As he had done many times, Paul wondered how he could explain the delicacy of the oracle, the timelines without number which vision waved before him on an undulating fabric. He sighed, remembered water lifted from a river in the hollow of his hands, trembling, draining. Memory drenched his face in it. How could he drench himself in futures growing increasingly obscure from the pressures of too many oracles?
"You've not seen it, then," Chani said.
That vision future, scarce any longer accessible to him, except at the expenditure of life-draining effort, what could it show them except grief, Paul asked himself. He felt that he occupied an inhospitable middle zone, a wasted place where his emotions drifted, swayed, swept outward in unchecked restlessness.
Chani covered his legs, said,
"An heir to House Atreides, this is not something you leave to chance, or one woman."
That was a thing his mother might have said, Paul thought. He wondered if the Lady Jessica had been in secret communication with Chani. His mother would think in terms of House Atreides. It was a pattern bred and conditioned into her by the Bene Gesserit, and would hold true even now when her powers were turned against the sisterhood.
"You listened when Irulan came to me today," he accused.
"I listened."
She spoke without looking at him. Paul focused his memory on the encounter with Irulan. He'd let himself into the family salon, noted an unfinished robe on Chani's loom. There had been an acrid worm smell to the place, an evil odor which almost hid the underlying cinnamon bite of melange. Someone had spilled unchanged spice essence and left it to combine there with a spice-based rug. It had not been a felicitous combination. Spice essence had dissolved the rug. Oily marks lay congealed on the plastone floor where the rug had been. He'd thought to send for someone to clean away the mess, but Hara, Stilgar's wife and Chani's closest feminine friend, had slipped in to announce Irulan. He'd been forced to conduct the interview in the presence of that evil smell, unable to escape a Fremen superstition that evil smells foretold disaster. Hara withdrew as Irulan entered.
"Welcome," Paul said.
Irulan wore a robe of gray whale fur. She pulled it close, touched a hand to her hair. He could see her wondering at his mild tone. The angry words she'd obviously prepared for this meeting could be sensed leaving her mind in a welter of second thoughts.
"You came to report that the sisterhood had lost its last vestige of morality," he said.
"Isn't it dangerous to be that ridiculous?" she asked.
"To be ridiculous and dangerous, a questionable alliance," he said.
His renegade Bene Gesserit training detected her putting down an impulse to withdrawal. The effort exposed a brief glimpse of underlying fear, and he saw she'd been assigned a task not to her liking.
"They expect a bit too much from a princess of the blood royal," he said.
Irulan grew very still, and Paul became aware that she had locked herself into a vice-like control. A heavy burden indeed, he thought, and he wondered why prescient visions had given him no glimpse of this possible future. Slowly, Irulan relaxed. There was no point in surrendering to fear, no point in retreat, she had decided.